And this is Norman Minetta again.
He said, we're tracking an airplane coming in, but the transponder has been turned off. So we don't have any identification on the airplane. We know it's coming in fast.
A representation of the FAA radar scope, based on information obtained by 2020, shows the plane headed straight for what is known as P-56, Prohibited Airspace 56, which covers the White House and the Capitol, at a speed of about 500 miles an hour, with no radio contact whatsoever.
Danielle O'Brien, air traffic controller.
It would be unprecedented for a commercial plane to come screaming through your airspace at that kind of speed, unidentified, without making some type of communication.
This made it a perfect candidate for a shootdown, especially after two towers in New York had already been hit by an airplane. 5. The Secret Service had known about the incoming airplane for the last 30 minutes, so it's presumable they would have been ready to shoot it down if it became necessary.
One of them approximately 30 minutes out, one of them approximately 45 minutes out. So we knew we had some time, but little time.
Our supervisor picked up our line to the White House and started relaying to them the information. We have an unidentified, very fast-moving aircraft inbound toward your vicinity.
Despite all this, no one moved a finger as the unknown threat kept rushing towards the Capitol.
Someone came in and said to the vice president, there's a plane out about 50 miles out.
As the one nearest us got closer and closer, 6 minutes out, 5 minutes out.
The same person said to the vice president, Mr. Vice President, there's a plane 30 miles out.
Michael McCormick from the FAA.
The Washington controllers came up on the speakerphone and started counting down 10 miles from the White House.
Young man said, Mr. Vice President, the plane's 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And the vice president sort of whipped his head around and said, of course they do.
9 miles from the White House. 8 miles from the White House.
7 miles west. And it went 6, 5, 4.
All the way down to 1 mile from the White House.
But no missile was fired. Undisturbed, the plane turned around and went on to strike the Pentagon, causing the death of at least 125 people between military and civilians on the ground. Question. The Secret Service knew about the incoming plane for the last 30 minutes, was following it on radar, had the means to shoot it down, and should have done so in order to protect the Capitol, but they didn't. Why? In regards to the exchange between Cheney and the young man, can you suggest anything different from an order not to shoot down the plane as it was approaching Washington's protected airspace?
Part 2. The Hijackers.
While the military defense leaves many unanswered questions, even more doubts arise when taking a closer look at the 19 alleged terrorists. The first problem is that apparently these guys could barely fly at all. While they are known to have taken some flight lessons with small single-engine airplanes, none of them had ever flown a jet before in their life, let alone a large commercial airliner, which is obviously a league of its own. Adam Shaw is an acrobatic pilot and a flight instructor with 6,000 hours of experience, half of which spent flying upside down.
For people who are really piss-poor student pilots, to be able to get in the cockpit of big jets and fly them as accurately as they were flown at close to max speed and be able to hit the trade towers.
The idea that someone could make the transition from a small single-engine plane traveling at 100 miles an hour to a commercial airliner traveling at 500 miles an hour without a long, exhaustive training is very hard to believe.
Ross Eimer, former United Airlines pilot.
People don't realize that to hand fly an airliner at those speeds is extremely difficult, and particularly if you're a novice, because a novice that's learned in little airplanes, they over-control everything.
To justify this apparently impossible transition, the debunkers maintained that the terrorist had spent some time in flight simulators, and that the equipment they encountered in the Boeing cockpits on September 11 was similar to the simulators they had trained on. But this is false. For example, the only simulator Hani Hanjour is known to have ever trained in is the Boeing 737, an airplane designed in the 70s, with a totally different cockpit from the 757 he is alleged to have hijacked on September 11. If anything, his training would have confused him, not helped him in any way. Another argument by the debunkers is that all the hijackers really had to do once in the cockpits was to set the automatic pilot in order to reach their target. But this is hardly what happened on September 11. Dave Bottiglia is the air traffic controller who followed the hijacking of United 175.
Now, as I'm watching, United 175 makes a hard left-hand turn and starts climbing. Not only did he make a sharp turn, but he also climbed 3,000 feet in a matter of approximately 1 minute, which is a very fast rate of climb. This is something that we have never seen before.
After the sudden ascent, the plane started a breathtaking descent toward the ground.
We were counting down the altitudes, and they were descending right at the end at 10,000 feet per minute. That is absolutely unheard of for a commercial jet.
This is certainly not the way the automatic pilot would have taken you to Kennedy Airport.
It is unbelievable for the passengers in the back to withstand that type of force as they're descending. They're actually nosing the airplane down and doing it what I would call a power dive.
At 9:01 a.m., United 175 is hurtling at more than 400 miles per hour toward the Statue of Liberty and New York Harbor.
One of the controllers started counting out the altitudes, and he says, my God, he's going down at 8,000 feet a minute. Now it's 10,000 feet a minute. And he counted off 8, 6, 4, and he says, my God, he's in the ground on the next hit.
But he was not. According to the official version, Marwan Alshaki, a 23-year-old who has never flown a jet before in his life, levels the course, visually identifies the target, and performs a spectacular banking maneuver that brings the 767 to hit the South Tower under the world's astonished eyes. Question. Marwan Alshaki had never flown a jet before in his life, let alone a huge airliner. How was he able to perform ascents of 3,000 feet per minute and plunges of 10,000 feet per minute while keeping full control of the plane? And why would he want to take such unnecessary risks, including collisions with other airliners, instead of flying safely with the autopilot towards the intended target? Ziad Jarrah, the alleged hijacker of Flight 93, wasn't known for his piloting skills either. As reported by the 9/11 Commission in July 2001, he had asked to fly the Hudson Corridor near Manhattan with a small private plane. But because Hortman Flight School deemed Jarrah unfit to fly solo, he could fly this route only accompanied by an instructor. Yet we are asked to believe that only 2 months later, the same person was able to fully control a 100-ton airliner and perform some extreme descending maneuvers observed by Cleveland's air traffic controllers.
Stacy Taylor, air traffic controller of Flight 93.
I see this plane climbed up from his assigned altitude of 35,000 feet to 41,000 feet, turned around and aimed right back at where we were, and descended rapidly. And when a plane descends too fast, the computer can't keep up with it.
Ziad Jarrah had never flown a jet before in his life, let alone a large airliner. And even his experience with small airplanes was rather poor. How could he perform a descent so fast that the computer can't keep up with it while maintaining full control of the plane? And why would he need to take such an unnecessary risk, including collisions with other airplanes, instead of safely flying with the autopilot towards the intended target? But the feat of the century must be awarded to Hani Hanjour, a hopeless amateur who is alleged to have been at the controls of American 77. As he finally reached Washington and had the Pentagon in sight, Hani Hanjour did not make the easy choice and just plunged the plane onto the roofs of the building. He instead disconnected the autopilot and performed a hand-flown, high-speed descending maneuver of 330 degrees that brought him to lose sight of the target again while forcing him to a much more difficult approach close to the ground. Seen from above, the Pentagon offers some 30 acres of unobstructed target. Hitting it anywhere on the roofs would have caused a major devastation and possibly thousands of casualties. Coming in from the side instead, the approach is filled with obstacles, and the target is reduced to a tiny strip of cement coming at you at 500 miles an hour.
The debunkers state, amateurs drive planes like trucks.
The debunkers, however, seem to have a good explanation for this apparently illogical maneuver.
Normally, the plane would come down in a plunge. If you ask a pilot, he'll tell you, that's the most difficult maneuver. An expert pilot would do that. A less competent pilot handles the plane as if it were a bomb truck. He flies horizontally. He flies low and hits the building.
This very question has already been posed to professional pilots, but the answer was not what Attivissimo claims.
If you were to simulate the flight of someone who wants to hit the Pentagon, what course would you follow? Captain Giancarlo Tedeschi says, to be sure, I would certainly hit it from here. To make sure, you would come in from above. Coming in this way, either you hit the buildings closer to you, or you hit the buildings right behind, causing a major damage in any case.
Flying a jet near the ground instead does require some major skills, even for the most seasoned pilot.
With so many hours of flying experience, would you be able to fly this plane in the last 500 yards, from here to here, at 530 miles per hour? This is Captain Claudio Calavotti of Alitalia. I'd have to try really hard. For one, it would be difficult to fly so close to the ground. I know by my own experience in low-flying military training, the terrain dashes by at an incredible speed. Those who have engaged in this kind of activity can understand what it means to be flying 15 or 30 feet from the ground in a 110-ton airplane bolting at 500 miles an hour. You just touch the stick and it leaps off. How does one fly a plane at 530 miles an hour next to the ground? Is it possible? Well, like my colleague said, it's extremely difficult. It's complicated because even the smallest touch on the vertical plane raises or drops the airplane. Even a well-trained pilot would find it very difficult.
The debunkers insist that the maneuver would have been doable even by an amateur like Hani Hanjour.
This is Paolo Attivissimo. As you can see, the maneuver is anything but acrobatic. It's just a very wide turn.
To prove their point, the debunkers refer to a documentary by Dutch television in which the Pentagon attack is replicated in a flight simulator. But this simulation doesn't seem very accurate. First of all, the approach is made from a much higher angle, while the real plane came in so low that it clipped some of the light poles as it was flying at ground level. Secondly, the documentary doesn't offer precise indications on the speeds used during the simulation. In a more accurate simulation, done with a pilot with an experience similar to Hani Hanjour, the results were quite different.
You hit something, but obviously it was not that building.
370 knots.
Oh, come on, hang on. I'm gonna get him. I missed again.
There's no denying it's incredibly difficult, especially with that turn that the NTSB data said Flight 77 made. And then he levels off and then pretty much just guns it straight in. That straight path right in is really incredibly difficult.
Correct.
I couldn't do it. You couldn't do it.
Not at that speed.
Not at 500 knots.
In fact, the air traffic controllers were so impressed with the speed of the maneuver, they thought they were looking at a military jet.
But nobody knew that was a commercial flight at the time. Nobody knew that was American 77.
What did you think? It was a military flight of some kind?
I thought it was a military flight.
It was really moving fast.
It was moving very fast, like a military aircraft might move at a low altitude.
Air traffic controller Danielle O'Brien stated, "The speed, the maneuverability, the way that he turned, we all thought in the radar room, all of us experienced air traffic controllers, that that was a military plane. You don't fly a 757 in that manner. It's unsafe." Several military and civil pilots have expressed their skepticism about the maneuver. Commander Ralph Kolstad is a former fighter pilot, air flight instructor, and a retired commercial pilot with 27 years of experience. At the Pentagon, he stated, "The pilot of the Boeing 757 did quite a feat of flying. I have 6,000 hours of flying in Boeing 757s and 767s, and could not have flown in the way the flight path was described." Commander Ted Muga, former civil and military pilot, "I just can't imagine an amateur even being able to come close to performing a maneuver of that nature." Captain Russ Wittenberg, a former fighter pilot and an airline pilot for 35 years, "For a guy to just jump into the cockpit and fly like an ace is impossible. There is not one chance in 1,000. To expect the alleged airplane to run these maneuvers with a total amateur at the controls is simply ludicrous."
To be able to fly that curving, descending, high airspeed trajectory into a very low building, you have to be Chuck Yeager to fly that trajectory.
Not only was Hani Hanjour no Chuck Yeager, but apparently he was a terrible pilot with small planes as well. An instructor from one of his flight schools stated, "Hani Hanjour was not someone cut out to be a pilot. He had no motivation, a poor understanding of the basic principles of aviation, and poor judgment, combined with poor technical skills." The debunkers contend that Hanjour had obtained a regular pilot's license, and therefore he had to be able to fly. But it is exactly because of that license that major suspicions on Hanjour kept emerging. In a 2002 article called A Trainee Noted for Incompetence, the New York Times wrote that Hanjour was reported to the aviation agency after the instructors had found his piloting skills so shoddy and his grasp of English so inadequate that they questioned whether his pilot's license was genuine. The article concludes quoting a former employee at the flight school who said, "I'm still to this day amazed that he could have flown into the Pentagon. He could not fly at all." The manager of another flight school in Phoenix said, "I couldn't believe he had a commercial license of any kind with the skills that he had." At yet another flight school in Maryland, instructors found he had trouble controlling and landing the single-engine Cessna 172. This was confirmed in this radio interview by Neela Sagadevan, a pilot and an aeronautical engineer.
"Yeah, I got to say something about Honey Hanjour. I've spoken with two of his flight instructors. This guy could not solo a Cessna 150. It's a little single-engine two-seat trainer. And what I mean by solo, it's a pilot's first time out without anyone else in the cockpit with him. It's the most simple, most fundamental flying exercise one can engage in. You're seated inside the aircraft, you hit the power, you take off, make a couple of 90-degree turns, maximum altitude of around 900 to 1,000 feet, come back and land. One..."
You're saying this alleged hijacker, Honey Hanjour, could not solo 150?
"He could not solo. In fact, one of his flight instructors, and I quote him, he said, the man could not fly at all."
How could an amateur who was deemed unable to fly solo in a Cessna 150, had a poor understanding of the basic principles of aviation, and had never sat once in the cockpit of a 757, suddenly become able to control such a large airliner flying at top speeds? And even assuming he was able to reach Washington with the autopilot, why would he want to disconnect it and hand-fly the plane for another 8 long minutes, performing a totally unnecessary descending maneuver that A. would have drastically increased his chances of an unwanted crash, B. would have increased the danger of being intercepted, C. would have made him lose sight of the target again, D. would have forced him to a much more difficult approach near the ground, E. would have shrunk the target to a tiny strip of cement, F. would have limited the possible damage to the external rings only, when he could have maximized the damage and ensured the most spectacular outcome of the mission by plunging the plane onto the Pentagon's roofs from above?
Part 2 on the hijackers. Did someone know?
It should be noted that such an illogical maneuver from a terrorist's point of view becomes almost mandatory if seen from the opposite side of the chessboard. If the operation was in fact orchestrated by someone within the military, no one would want a 757 to plunge from the sky onto the Pentagon's roof. That would cause a major devastation, cost thousands of lives, and possibly kill generals and even the Secretary of Defense. To justify the claim of having been attacked, all that was needed was a strike on the side wall in a less populated area away from the top brass offices, where the number of casualties would be kept to a minimum. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but the area of the Pentagon that was hit with the strange maneuver not only satisfied all these requisites, but had just been reinforced in order to withstand a terrorist attack.
Exactly where the plane went in was an area that had recently been redeveloped with very heavy blast walls and firewalls. All the outside windows had been equipped with Kevlar coating to guard against blast. This portion of the building that had been remodeled, heavy blast walls put in, and the old portion had already been vacated in preparations of the remodeling effort, and the number of dead is probably considerably less than it would have been if this part of the Pentagon had been up to full staff. Fortunately, too, this is exactly the opposite side of all the critical command centers in the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense's office, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Office, the National Military Command, where some of the most critical military decisions are made. Fortunately, they were all on the other side of the building.
The renovated section had just been reinforced by floor-to-ceiling steel beams that ran through all five floors. When the building section collapsed, the structure was held together by the web of 6x6-inch steel columns. Between these columns was a Kevlar-like mesh, similar to the material in bulletproof vests, which kept masonry from becoming shrapnel in case of an explosion. The suspicion that a strike on this section of the building was expected doesn't rest on the major beefing up of the structure alone. Apparently, the rumor of a strike on the external ring had already been circulating among the top ranks of the military. On September 11, Jim Miklaszewski was the NBC correspondent at the Pentagon.
"The first time I heard the word terrorism out of any U.S. official came shortly after the second plane had hit. And I bumped into a U.S. military intelligence official, and I said, look, what have you got? And he said, obviously, this is clearly an act of terrorism. And then he got very close to me and almost silent for a few seconds, and he leaned in and he said, this attack was so well coordinated that if I were you, I would stay off the E-ring where our NBC office was, the outer ring of the Pentagon, the rest of the day, because we're next.
Question. Even if someone could predict that the Pentagon would become a target, one would imagine a plane to plunge from the skies onto the roofs of the building. Why would anyone suggest to stay away from the external ring in particular unless he knew in advance what was going to happen?
The next section is entitled The Airport Security Cameras.
While we were asked to believe that 19 Islamic terrorists were responsible for the hijackings, no one has ever produced a single image of these alleged terrorists boarding the four hijacked airplanes. All major airports in the world have security cameras practically everywhere, covering every public area of the airport 24 hours a day. But the only image of the terrorists released after 9/11 was this shot from a security camera showing alleged hijackers Abdulaziz Al-Omari and Mohammed Atta going through a security checkpoint. The two men, however, are not boarding Flight American 11 from Boston to Los Angeles, but a previous connecting flight from Portland, Maine to Boston in the early hours of September 11. Only in 2005 were some images of the terrorists in one of the three airports released. They showed the group that allegedly hijacked Flight 77 passing through security checks at Washington Dulles. But the timestamp, which is always embedded in security camera recordings, was either cropped out or absent altogether. This means that the video could have been shot at any time prior to 9/11, possibly during a dry run the terrorists did along the same routes. In fact, the 9/11 Commission has stated that many of the terrorists, including Atta, Sheikhi, Jarrah, Hanjour, Hazmi, took cross-country surveillance flights early in the summer. There is another element that makes these images suspicious. In 2001, most security cameras functioned as time-lapse photography, recording an average of one frame per second. This video instead is a continuous recording, similar to those obtained with regular consumer-type camcorders. In any case, the fact remains that in 10 years, we have never seen a single image proving that the 19 alleged terrorists boarded the hijacked airplanes. To address this blatant oddity, the 9/11 Commission wrote that the security checkpoint in Newark, like the checkpoints in Boston, lacked closed-circuit television surveillance. But in a Los Angeles Times article dated September 13, 2001, former FBI Assistant Director Louis Shaliro is quoted saying that FBI agents examined footage from dozens of cameras at the three airports where the terrorists boarded the aircraft. We also have the account by David Brent, a technical information engineer who worked for the company that had installed the security cameras at Dulles. After the 9/11 attacks, Brent stated, I was part of a team that had the laborious task of reviewing all the video from the airport. That's every frame from over 300 cameras with 30 days of retention time. The task took 3 weeks of 15-hour days. So where are the images of the terrorists? Even if the checkpoints from two of the three airports didn't have cameras, we should have dozens of images of the 19 terrorists standing in line for the check-in, getting their boarding passes, moving through the lounge areas, making phone calls, using stairs and conveyor belts, visiting the duty-free shops, or having a snack before departure. Each of these premises has also plenty of cameras of their own, which are used to keep an eye on their customers. And then we should have seen the terrorists seated in the departure lounges, waiting for the boarding call, and finally proceeding through the gates that would take them to the airplanes. But we have never seen any of this. Question. Why were we never shown a single image of the 19 alleged hijackers moving through the different areas of the three airports on the morning of September 11? Since Washington Dulles did have security cameras at the checkpoints, why were we never shown the properly time-stamped images of the five terrorists boarding Flight 77 on the morning of September 11? Not only do we not have a single image of the 19 hijackers at the three airports on September 11, but we also don't have a single soundbite of their voices from the four cockpit voice recorders. With four hijackings that lasted between 18 and 41 minutes each, we should have some 2 hours of continuous recordings of what happened in the cockpits of the four airplanes. We should have heard the struggles of the terrorists storming in and overcoming the pilots. And then we should have heard their conversations in Arabic as they try to figure out where they are and how to get from there to their designated targets. But we never heard any of that. For American 11, the plane that hit the first tower, we were told that the cockpit voice recorder was never found. For United 175, the plane that hit the second tower, we were also told that the cockpit voice recorder was never found. For the flight that hit the Pentagon, we were told that the voice recorder was found, but it was damaged to the point that the contents were unusable. This is very curious, as black boxes are built specifically to withstand extremely high temperatures and the most violent of impacts.
Planes have two so-called black boxes, actually painted orange to make them more visible. They're kept at the back of the plane. Two shells of stainless steel and a heat-protective material shield the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. They can withstand pressure down to 6,000 meters and heat of 1,100 degrees centigrade.
For United 93, the voice recorder was found, we were told, and was in good condition. But, for unknown reasons, the recording was never made public. In December 2001, members of the victims' families formally asked the FBI to release the voice recordings from the cockpit of Flight 93. But the FBI replied, "While we empathize with the grieving families, we do not believe that the horror captured on the cockpit voice recording will console them in any way." At the end of the day, the only sound bites from the alleged hijackers we ever heard are a couple of clips recorded by air traffic controllers on the ground as the terrorists apparently punched the wrong keys talking to their passengers.
Buddy, move, please. Going back to the airport. Don't try to make any stupid moves.
Curiously, the hijacker from another flight made the exact same mistake.
Hi, the captain. I would like to know if you may see it. We are all aboard and are going to back to the airport.
But these recordings could have been transmitted by anyone and from anywhere. They don't prove that the terrorists were actually aboard the planes. In fact, the opposite suspicion arises in this case. Just as the Portland images seem to be the perfect substitute for the complete lack of images of the 19 terrorists at the three airports, these short sound bites, apparently generated by mistake, seem to be the perfect substitute for the complete lack of conversations from the four cockpit voice recorders. The situation becomes even more implausible if we look at the actual flight data recorders, the devices that store the technical information from the plane during the flight. For the two airplanes that hit the towers, again, we are told that the flight data recorders were never found. In the months following the destruction of the Twin Towers, every ounce of rubble that left Ground Zero was meticulously combed through in the effort to recover every possible human remain.
That's when we decided the very least that we can do. If we can't bring them home to their families alive, then we'll stick it out and bring them home to their families. There wasn't a piece of rubble that left that pit that wasn't gone over with a fine-tooth comb.
This practice went on until the end of the removal operations.
The big pile that you see in the background there is what remains of one of the towers. A tractor basically comes in, takes a shovel full of it, and then he feathers it out across the field out there. The guys take rakes, and they rake through it. It's very tedious, but we find bones constantly.
As if that weren't enough, the same search was repeated at the Freshkills landfill in New Jersey.
Every single piece of debris, having already been combed through at Ground Zero, went through three more passes under the careful eyes of officers and agents of the FBI and the NYPD.
There's a picture of some very painstaking searching going on, with pieces of rubble not more than a couple of inches on a conveyor belt.
Yet we are asked to believe that not one, but four bright orange, practically indestructible voice and data recorders eluded a search so meticulous that it was able to recover dozens of watches, banknotes, personal documents, and even buckets of coins. For the other two flights, the one that hit the Pentagon and the one that crashed in Pennsylvania, the flight data recorders were found, we were told, and were in good condition. It's from these two black boxes that the animations depicting the full flight of American 77 in United 93 were extracted. These two black boxes, however, pose a big problem. Every flight data recorder carries a metal plaque indicating the exact model and serial number of that device. This allows a flight data recorder to always be matched to the plane it was mounted on, while providing some important technical information. As explained by the NTSB, the serial number is used to identify when a recorder manufacturer switched from a certain memory configuration to another. This information is necessary to perform the correct recovery of the data. In virtually every accident report filed by the NTSB in the last 20 years, both the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder's serial numbers are listed. But in the reports from Flight 77 and Flight 93, for some reason, they are not. An independent researcher has filed several Freedom of Information Act requests with the NTSB, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the FBI, requesting information on the missing serial numbers. But his requests were always denied. As no one has ever released the serial numbers of the two flight data recorders, it's impossible to know whether they came from Flight 77 and Flight 93, or from a totally different source. All in all, we have this paradoxical situation where the contents of 6 black boxes out of 8 were never released, while the other 2 cannot be verified as genuine both in origin and content. As far as we know, the 4 airplanes that crashed on September 11 could have been totally different machines from those that left the airports earlier that morning.
Part 3. The airplanes, passenger jets or military drones?
The obvious inability by these amateurs to fly the 4 airplanes in the way they were flown, and the total lack of proof that they were even aboard those planes, poses a serious question. If not them, then who was piloting the planes? One thing everyone can agree on is that no professional pilot in the world would ever crash his own plane into a highly populated target like the Pentagon or the Twin Towers in New York. Even at gunpoint, once he knew his plane was doomed, at the last minute he would steer it away from a populated target or plunge it directly into the sea.
I don't believe any airline pilot would intentionally fly into the World Trade Center, even with a gun at his head.
It is inconceivable to me that any airline pilot would allow anyone to force him to fly into an inhabited building. I cannot imagine how any pilot could be conscious or capable of doing anything to control that airplane at the time that it was directed at one of these buildings.
But then, who was in the cockpits? What may seem as a far-fetched possibility was actually suggested by TV reporters less than 10 minutes after the impact on the second tower.
That is a very large aircraft. It would be enormously significant if someone was able in some way to get their hands on a 727 or a similar size commercial aircraft and then crash that in.
Ollie?
Reporter Dick Oliver.
Jim, what you're saying could be a drone aircraft. That's an aircraft that's guided electronically to its target without having a pilot. Now that is a possibility as well.
One fact that seems to support this possibility are the exceptional speeds these airplanes were able to achieve at low altitudes, near sea level. As we know, a person can easily run at top speed through normal air, but he cannot do the same in a much thicker medium like water. At 30,000 feet, the air is very thin, and the airplane can easily travel beyond 500 miles an hour without encountering much resistance. As soon as it starts descending, however, the atmosphere gets thicker and thicker, and the plane needs to reduce the speed accordingly in order to preserve its structural integrity. Below 10,000 feet in altitude, speeds around 250 miles per hour are recommended. In fact, each airplane has a specific maximum operating velocity, called VMO, which should never be exceeded at low altitudes. Never means never for a reason. Should the VMO be exceeded, a phenomenon called flutter can occur, which can quickly cause irreversible damage. The flutter phenomenon can affect any kind of airplane, from large military bombers to small single-engine airplanes. Once the VMO is exceeded, not only are the wings and the ailerons at risk, but also the fuselage begins suffering from the air pressure caused by the speed. This is what happened to an Air China 747, which exceeded the maximum operating speed, or VMO, in the desperate effort to recover from an engine failure.
For the first time, Captain Ho takes manual control of the plane.
Airspeed 270, 280.
The plane is about to exceed its maximum speed.
Approaching VMO.
The stress of the dive tears the landing gear doors off the plane.
Pass VMO. Emergency. Emergency.
Luckily, the pilots were able to regain control of the plane and perform an emergency landing. The damage caused by the excess velocity was visible all over the plane. The maximum operating speed for a 767, 2 of the 4 hijacked airplanes, is 414 miles per hour. For the other two airplanes, the 757s, the VMO is even less, 402 miles per hour. Yet on 9/11, all four airplanes were flown at speeds close to or beyond 500 miles per hour near sea level without suffering any visible structural damage, while remaining perfectly under control all the way into their targets.
American 11 hit high up in the North Tower around the 93rd floor, going a pretty astonishing rate of speed, almost 500 miles an hour.
Here comes a very large target, descending rapidly, very fast.
Diving very steeply and very fast.
He's really moving.
He was moving fast.
United Flight 175, streaking through the skies over New York at more than 600 miles an hour, barely missed colliding with another commercial flight.
The back of my neck stands up when we talk about the hijacking. We watched the speed, very high rate of speed. I believe it was about 600 knots southbound, which was extremely unusual for an air carrier.
According to the NTSB, during the descent from 12,000 to 6,000 feet, the aircraft ground speed remained between 500 and 520 knots. It then impacted World Trade Center Tower 2 at approximately 510 knots ground speed. 510 knots is 586 miles per hour. That's almost 200 miles per hour beyond the maximum operating velocity of a 767. American 77 also impressed the air traffic controllers for the speed in approaching Washington.
Danielle O'Brien, Washington Air Traffic Control.
It was an unidentified plane to the southwest of Dulles, moving at a very high rate of speed.
I slid over to the controller on my left,
and I asked him, "Do you see an unidentified plane there southwest of Dulles?" And his response was, "Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. Look how fast he is."
Full throttle.
Full out.
The plane made its circular descent at about 350 miles an hour. Then it kept accelerating until it crashed into the Pentagon, says the commission report, traveling at approximately 530 miles per hour. While flying at 5,000 feet of altitude, United 93 began performing a series of hard left and right maneuvers at 350 miles per hour. This was followed by a series of similar up and down maneuvers while flying near 400 miles per hour. Yet Zihad Jarad, the amateur who wasn't allowed to fly solo on a single-engine airplane, braved the roller coaster without ever losing control. As the plane was descending, he even kept accelerating until the aircraft plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at 580 miles per hour. These exceptional speeds, achieved at low altitudes, have raised more than an eyebrow among aeronautical experts and pilots alike, especially those who had flown the actual airplanes involved in 9/11.
Russ Wittenberg, retired from the U.S. Air Force and United Airlines.
I flew the two actual aircraft which were involved in 9/11, the flight number 175 and flight 93, the 757 that allegedly went down at Shanksville, and flight 175 is the aircraft that's alleged to have hit the South Tower. I don't believe it's possible for a terrorist, a so-called terrorist, to train on a 172, then jump in a cockpit of a 757, 767 glass cockpit, and vertical navigate the aircraft, lateral navigate the aircraft, and fly the airplane at speeds exceeding its design limit speed by well over 100 knots, make high-speed, high-bank turns, exceeding, pulling probably 5, 6, 7 Gs, and the aircraft would literally fall out of the sky. I couldn't do it, and I'm absolutely positive they couldn't do it.
How do you feel about United 175 reaching 510 knots?
Ralph Kolstad, 23,000 hours of flying, Boeing 757, 767s, 20 years in the U.S. Navy, twice Top Gun.
It's physically impossible to have a clocked airspeed of 510 knots with a commercial airliner at sea level is physically impossible.
Flight 175 that hit the second tower, they said it was going at roughly 560 miles an hour at sea level.
Ben Eady, aeronautical engineer.
No, that's impossible. You need so much power to push yourself through that air. So the engines have the right amount of horsepower for cruising at 30,000 feet at 500 plus miles an hour. To do that at ground level, you need six times that amount of power. Those engines can't put out six times more power. If you changed out the motors so they were motors that had six times the thrust, then, you know, theoretically you could, but then the structure is not strong enough. Under all circumstances, I'd say an absolute resounding no.
Ross Amer, 30,000 plus hours flying, captain of a Boeing 757-767, including time in United 93 and United 175.
To me, it's impossible. You know, any pilots that has been in a commercial jet would probably laugh at if you said 510 knots.
Is it possible to fly over 500 miles an hour at sea level?
Captain Gordon Wilson, aeronautical engineer.
No. It would be above the indicated airspeed would be greater than its maximum speed at sea level.
Even, like, say if it was even in a shallow type of dive, would it be able to...
Any airplane can be dive, of course, then you've got the assistance of gravity, right? But there comes a point where the drag of the air overcomes the aerodynamics of the airplane.
For a final word, the same researcher has called Boeing Corporation.
It has to do with the maximum speed of a 767-200 at 700 feet altitude.
Leslie Hazard, Boeing spokesperson.
For 200?
Yeah, 767-200, yeah. Like, I had asked some people, and they assumed it would be about 250 miles an hour or something.
That sounds pretty likely, because at 35,000 feet, it's 530 miles.
So there's no way that it could be going 500 miles an hour at 700 feet altitude, then?
Not a chance. Not that fast.
Question. Can you produce any evidence that a Boeing 767 equipped with regular engines can fly for almost 2 minutes beyond 500 miles per hour in the lower strata of the atmosphere without suffering any visible structural damage? Can you explain how amateur pilots who had never flown a jet before in their life could maintain full control of an airliner that has exceeded the VMO by almost 200 miles per hour? And why would some terrorists who have been lucky enough to get within reach of their target want to risk the entire operation by imposing such a stress on the airplane that it would almost certainly cause them to crash before they complete their mission?
What happened to the passengers?
One question becomes inevitable at this point. If those were military drones and not regular airliners, what happened to the passengers? With certainty, no one can answer this question. One thing we do know, however, the CIA has been developing plans for covert operations that involve the in-flight swapping of commercial airliners with military drones since the 1960s. One such plan was called Operation Northwoods, and it detailed how to replace a civil airliner with a military drone in mid-air, unbeknownst to the air traffic controllers. After the swap, the airliner would be landed in a military base. The drone would continue to fly, appearing on radar as the original plane, and would be remotely guided all the way into the target. We don't know whether this is the actual end the passengers met, but one thing we can say for sure, those who called their relatives from their cell phones could not have placed those calls from the airplanes in flight.
The telephone calls.
Minutes after the fourth plane had crashed in Pennsylvania, news was already circulating that several passengers had made calls with their cell phones from the hijacked airplanes.
We are being hijacked. We are being hijacked. Those frightening words were uttered by a passenger aboard United Flight 93 who was able to call emergency personnel on his cell phone before the plane crashed in western Pennsylvania.
And tonight we're getting reports of cell phone calls from at least three of those four flights. On the second flight that came out of Boston, that was the second flight of the day, and also went into one of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, there was a businessman who got off two cell phone calls to his father.
The CNN commentator Barbara Olson, wife of U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson. She reportedly called her husband twice on a mobile phone to tell him her plane was being hijacked.
The problem is that in 2001, it was practically impossible to make a call with a cell phone from an airplane at cruising altitudes. The whole idea behind cellular phones is that they use low power transmitters, both to keep the cost of the units down and to preserve battery life. It is up to the receiving towers on the ground to pick up and boost their signal before they route it through the system. It is commonly thought that beyond 10,000 feet in altitude, most cell phones become useless. Passenger planes normally cruise at 30,000 feet and beyond. The editors of Popular Mechanics, however, maintain that cell phones do work from cruising airplanes, even at maximum altitudes.
This is David Dunbar, a debunker from Popular Mechanics.
David Dunbar.
With regard to the cell phones, we did what any reporter would do. We talked to experts
in the field, and in fact, cell phones do work at that altitude, up to 35,000 feet and higher. And
in 2001?
In 2001, and it might be instructive for you to talk to some of the cell phone experts.
Instead of talking to experts, Japanese television decided to take matters into their own hands. In 2003, they conducted an on-camera experiment near Ontario, Canada, to verify the actual reach of cell phones from different altitudes.
The cellular phone system used in the experiment in Canada is the one used in the United States. Three cell phones, each from different telephone companies, were used. The experiment begins at 1,000 feet.
Hello?
Hello, I'm calling from cell phone A.
The results were the same with the other two. Next, we went up to 4,000 feet. Then...
Not on me.
Company B's phone stopped working at 4,000 feet. And when the aircraft rose to 6,000 feet, Company A's phone also became useless. At 8,000 feet, none of the three cell phones worked anymore.
No service on A, no service on B, no service on C.
In other words, at an altitude of 35,000 feet, cell phones would have been totally useless.
There is another problem besides altitude that makes calling from a cell phone unthinkable from a cruising airplane, and that is speed. Calling from an aircraft with a cell phone would be like calling from a car traveling at 500 miles per hour. The connection would continuously need to be transferred from one receiving station to the next, and then to the next, and again to the next. The transfer procedure between two receiving stations is called handoff, and it relies on continuous triangulations between the receiving towers in order to establish the exact position of the caller. As the mobile unit approaches the handoff zone, the first tower senses the weakening of the signal and prepares to transfer the call to the second. When the second tower senses the signal is strong enough to take over, the handoff procedure is initiated. If everything goes well, the call is rerouted into the system by the new receiving station. But the speed by which an airplane approaches and crosses over the handoff zone is so high that the towers wouldn't have the time to complete the handoff procedure. The call would be dropped, and the person would need to dial the number from scratch. If one considers the altitude and the speed problems combined, it should be clear that the chances of having an actual conversation with a cell phone from a cruising airplane are practically nil. Even after 2001, both altitude and speed problems remain. In 2005, the Washington Post wrote, "Most cell phones can't reach a station from beyond 10,000 feet. Another technical hurdle is to find a way that cell phone calls would be handed off from one cell tower to another on the ground when an aircraft is traveling at 500 miles an hour." And even 10 years after 9/11, people who try to use their cell phone from cruising altitudes are bound to get the same results. Once it became clear that the passengers could not have placed their calls from the cell phones on the airplanes, the official narrative on this issue became more and more ambiguous and non-committal. Theodore Olson, who had initially told the press he had received two cell phone calls from his wife Barbara, changed his story to calls made from an airphone. And by the time the 9/11 Commission published their final report, only one mention on the cell phone calls remained. Shortly thereafter, wrote the commission, passengers and flight crew began a series of calls from GTA airphones and cellular phones. No indication on which calls were made from cell phones and which ones with airphones was given. The authorities from the Massawi trial also avoided being too specific on the origin of the calls. Within the official documentation, they released this flash animation, which contains all the basic information on the four hijacked airplanes. By clicking on any of the flights, one can view the passengers list. By clicking on the telephone icon at the bottom, the passengers who have made phone calls are highlighted. And by clicking on any of the passengers' names, the list of the calls they have made is displayed. Each of the calls lists the exact time it was placed, the duration, the initial part of the number dialed, and the name of the person receiving the call. But the number from which the phone call was placed is missing. The only information available is the location on the plane the calls were presumably made from, row 30 in this case. It's as if the authorities were trying to suggest that the calls were made from airphones without having to put it down on paper. Only in two cases did the authorities openly state that a cell phone was used. One is the call allegedly placed to 911 by a passenger who had locked himself in a lavatory where airphones are not available. The second is a call placed by flight attendant C.C. Lyles to her husband, who later described his surprise in receiving a call from her cell phone in a television interview.
Once the phone got disconnected, then I sat up in the bed. Like, it was like I just woke up. I'm like, was that a real call? So I looked at the caller ID and noticed that it was a call, and it was from her cell phone. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. How can she call me from on the plane from a cell phone? Because cell phones don't work on a plane. That's what I'm thinking.
As only these two phone calls were admitted by the authorities, the debunkers have universally adopted the only two cell phone calls made position. But one thing is the number of cell phone calls admitted to. Another is the number of calls that were actually made. In the days following 9/11, the FBI interviewed the various people who had received a phone call from their relatives on the planes. And their reports tell a different story. One of the reports reads, starting at approximately 6:30 Pacific Standard Time, which is 9:30 New York time, Dina Burnett received a series from 3 to 5 cellular phone calls from her husband, Thomas Burnett. Burnett was able to determine her husband was using his own cellular phone because the caller ID showed his number. Only one of the calls did not show the caller ID as she was on the line with another call. According to the official documentation, Thomas Burnett made a total of 3 calls, one at 9:30, one at 9:37, and one at 9:44. This means that at least 2 of these calls, if not all 3, were made from Burnett's cellular phone. At 9:30, the plane was flying at 32,000 feet and climbing. At 9:37, it had reached 36,000 feet and was still climbing. At 9:44, it had descended to 22,000 feet, while it accelerated until reaching a ground speed of almost 400 miles per hour. None of these calls seems to have been possible with a cell phone from that airplane. According to another report, United 93 passenger Jeremy Glick saw hijackers on the plane, used a cell phone, and called Makeley, his stepmother, to report the hijacking. He then asked to talk to his wife, Lisbeth.
And he was on the phone and he had told me that his plane had been hijacked.
According to the FBI, Glick's wife, Lisbeth, could not hear any unusual sounds in the background of the call, and the connection was extremely clear, as if he was calling from the next room. Cell phone communication was lost at 9:55. Glick placed the call at 9:37, which means the communication lasted uninterrupted for 18 minutes while the plane was flying between 39,000 and 10,000 feet at an average speed of almost 400 miles per hour. Only a miracle could have kept that connection open for all that time had the call truly been placed from the airplane in flight. Lauren Grancolis possessed a cellular phone and is believed to have allowed another passenger, Honor Wainio, to use the cellular phone. Wainio placed one call to her parents at 9:53, when the plane was at about 10,000 feet, traveling close to 400 miles per hour. Elsa Strong received a cell phone call from her sister, Lisa Granlund, a passenger on United 93. Granlund made the call to her sister at 9:46, when the plane was at 17,000 feet and traveling at almost 400 miles per hour. Marion Britton was also a passenger on United 93. Britton's live-in boyfriend received a cellular phone call from Britton during the hijacking. Britton told Fiamano, her boyfriend, that she had borrowed a cell phone from another passenger. Britton's call to Fiamano took place at 9:49, when United 93 was flying beyond 13,000 feet at a speed of 420 miles per hour. Peter Hansen, a passenger on United 175, contacted his mother on cell phone and said the flight had been hijacked. Peter's father, Lee, said that he resisted the temptation to call his son back because he didn't want to place him in more danger by having his cell phone ring on the plane. Peter Hansen called his parents twice, at 8:52 and at 9 a.m. At 8:52, the plane was at 30,000 feet and it was climbing. At 9 o'clock, it was flying at over 18,000 feet in altitude, while it accelerated towards the record-breaking speed of almost 600 miles per hour near sea level. Brian Sweeney was also a passenger on United 175. After learning of the attacks, wrote the FBI, his wife Julie Sweeney returned home to find that her husband had left a message made from his cell phone aboard the plane on their answering machine. Sweeney made the call at 8:58 in between the two Hansen calls when the plane was still at 25,000 feet in altitude. While any one of these phone calls could have momentarily been connected by a set of fortunate coincidences, it should be obvious that all these cell phone calls as a whole could not have been made from the cruising airplanes. Question. Given the known limitations of the cellular phone system in 2001, can you provide any evidence that the cell phone calls made by the passengers reported by the FBI could have been made from the altitudes, at the speeds, and for the durations indicated for each of them? We do know, however, that the calls were made, as no one has ever doubted that the relatives actually received them. This opens the way to a disturbing possibility, which seems to support the in-flight swap hypothesis, that the passengers were forced to call their relatives under duress, pretending to be on the airplane, while in fact they had already been landed in some unknown location. In support of this hypothesis, we have different elements. One is the conversation passenger Todd Beamer had with a GTA airphone operator, Lisa Jefferson, during the hijack of Flight 93. It is through Lisa Jefferson that the whole world learned about the famous call to action, "Let's roll."
When he told the guys, "Are you ready?" I assumed that they were waiting on his cue. Then they responded to him, and he said, "Okay, let's roll."
The 9/11 Commission has established that the hijack took place at 9:28. Todd Beamer was connected to Lisa Jefferson at 9:43, some 15 minutes into the hijacking. The FBI report confirms that Jefferson received the call from Beamer at approximately 8:45 Central Time, which is 9:45 Eastern. But the contents of the conversation are strikingly at odds with the official narrative. According to Jefferson, Beamer called to state that the plane was about to be hijacked. He stated that three individuals, two wielding knives, the third with a bomb strapped to his waist with a red belt, were preparing to take control of the flight. Jefferson estimated that she spoke to Beamer for 7 minutes before the two hijackers armed with knives entered the cockpit. This places the hijacking at around 9:52, while officially it took place at 9:28. This is no small discrepancy. How could Beamer be describing events that are supposed to be happening in front of his eyes when in fact they had already happened half an hour before? How could the terrorists be preparing to take control of the flight at 9:45 when they had already been in the cockpit for more than 15 minutes? The FBI also wrote that Jefferson noted that the call had an unusually low amount of background noise, the same thing Liz Glick had noticed. Furthermore, the records show that Beamer's call lasted roughly 1 hour and that the line was left open after the crash. "We didn't lose a connection," stated Jefferson, "because there's a different sound that you use. I never lost connection. It just went silent." Jefferson stayed on the phone, stated the FBI, until she learned Flight 93 had crashed. Question: since airphones are powered by the same airplane's electrical system, how could the line have remained open for another 45 minutes after the plane had literally disintegrated to the ground in 1,000 pieces? All these discrepancies seem to suggest that Beamer was not on the plane, observing real events unfolding, but was describing an imaginary, pre-scripted situation from a different location. In support of this hypothesis, we also have the dramatic message left by flight attendant Cece Lyles in her husband's answering machine before briefly talking to him on her cell phone. As she herself is suggesting, we should listen very carefully.
Tuesday, 9:47 a.m.
"Hi, baby. Baby, you have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. Want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that."
We too can notice the absence of the typical background noise heard inside a plane.
"I don't know what to say. There are three guys. They've hijacked the plane. I'm trying to be calm."
After saying goodbye, she seems to fumble with the headset while she whispers a few more words into the mouthpiece.
"I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye."
End of message.
Even by playing the segment several times, it remains difficult to hear anything different from the words, "It's a frame." In any case, the problem with the phone calls does not change. The cell phone calls confirmed by the FBI in their reports cannot have been made from the cruising airplanes. Someone has to explain where they came from.
Now, my hearty congratulations to the author for putting that film together, and thank you to Olivier for putting it my way. I suspect we shall have part two next time. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from MP3 Archive at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco is "The Unwelcome Guest" with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.